You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, December 28th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, my daughter has off from elementary school, and so shall I have off from producing live shows. As such, we continue on our week in review, sort of, with qualifications and caveats. Some of the material is new, but look, it's much harder to brand it that way. Today on the program, by my demand, we're replaying an interview I did with Jacob Hacker, and okay, technically it wasn't in 2011, but the issues are just as important. I did this, this is one of the earliest interviews I did on the relaunch of The Majority Report. It's about a book he wrote with Paul Pearson, and it is incredibly relevant to the struggles of Occupy Wall Street and the themes of this year. Also, interview with Kevin Drum, who wrote a piece, Plutocracy Now. And you know what? Frankly, I don't know if that was from 2011 either. Oh, no, it was. But it's also very important. Particularly, you know, the implications for what Madison, Wisconsin protests meant this past year. And also for alliances that are being forged at Occupy Wall Street. And we will also include in today's podcast for you some picks from the Best of the Left podcast of our show. Best of the Left podcast, what it does is he does a podcast twice a week, and he pulls the best of the left. And so when he heard that we were doing some year-in-review stuff, he sent me a list of the 10 that he thought were the best. And this guy does this professionally. So who am I to argue? So folks, stick around for all that. Tomorrow we will have another Best of the Majority Report show. It will be a compilation of our Occupy Wall Street coverage over the past several months. And we'll include the Fran Lebowitz interview as demanded by the public.
That was without a doubt the highest demanded interview in terms of best ofs that we've done.
All right, so in the meantime, enjoy today's show. On the phone, Professor Jacob Hacker of Yale. He is the author, co-author, I should say, of Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. He authored this book with Paul Pearson of Berkeley. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks very much for having me on, Sam.
The book is, and I have to start right up front by telling you that I've only been able to read excerpts at this point, but from what I've been reading about the book and what I've read of the book, it really does seem, and I'm not the first person to say this, this is an incredibly timely book, and it could very well be one of the most important books about politics in years. And I say that coming from the perspective of someone who is somewhat disillusioned with what we've seen from the past 2 years of Democratic control in terms of addressing issues like income inequality and issues like
financial regulation and taxation policy. And so just lay out for us the central thesis of your book.
Well, thanks for the kind words, Sam. I hope that you continue to think it's a great book when you've finished reading it. And it really turns out to be a pretty timely book, and perhaps more timely than we knew when we were writing it. When I say we, I mean my co-author Paul Pearson and I, because this last election and the amount of money that was thrown into it certainly reinforced our sense that there's a real challenge to a vibrant participatory middle-class democracy, and one that we think really needs to be addressed. And yeah, I mean, the basic argument of the book is that we've seen a generation in which most of the economic gains have gone to those at the top of the economic ladder. Fully 40% of all the household income gains between 1979 and 2007 accrued to the richest 1% of Americans. And we've seen that it's not just the richest 1%, but the richest 1/10 of 1%, 1/100 of 1% that have really shot into the economic stratosphere, while middle-class Americans have had to deal with the great financial crisis of the last few years, as well as slow or no growth in their incomes. And that's, to us, pretty puzzling, because this is, after all, a democratic society and system that's supposed to be highly responsive to the middle class. So our book is really a kind of a mystery story of how this happened and what it means for all of us and how we might turn it around.
Now, I just want to reiterate one point that you mentioned there, is that this isn't just simply about income disparity. It's about the incredibly intense concentration of wealth in a very small group of people's hands.
Yeah, I mean, it's really about two sides of that picture. One is the concentration at the top, and that's why we call the book Winner Take All Politics. It really is striking how concentrated the gains are among this very small circle of winners. One way to get a look at this is to take a look at the income tax statistics that two economists, Emmanuel Saez and Thomas Piketty, have put together. And what they show is that in the 1970s, about $1 in $10 was earned by the richest 1% of Americans, and by the 2007, just before the financial crisis, we were talking about $1 in $4 being earned by this richest 1%. But what's even more striking is that it's really the small slices of that top 1% that have really reaped the lion's share of the gains. Say the top 1/10 of 1%, which had an average income of around $7 million. And so we really misunderstand what's happened if we focus just on kind of the broadening of the income ladder. What's really happened is the very top rungs have shot up into the clouds. And the other trend that I think it's really important to understand is this is not a victimless development. It's not as if it's just Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and Warren Buffett are getting richer and richer and the rest of us are just sort of getting to enjoy the trickle-down fruits. What we show is that over the same period that the very top pulled away, middle-class Americans saw their economic security decline, their income mobility stagnate, the college completion rate stagnate, debt levels skyrocket, and so on. And so we're talking about a really fundamentally negative story for most Americans, alongside this story of super gains at the very top, and we're basically arguing that the link between these two really comes down to politics, not some kind of impersonal economic change, not technology, not globalization, but
right.
What government did and didn't do.
That was what I was going to ask you. That there are people who will argue that this is the natural state of globalization or highly skilled and educated workers, because of the nature of our new economy, do better. But you quite clearly show that it's not a function of that.
Yeah, I mean, we have a number of ways that we try to knock that down. I mean, the first thing to note is that the suspect has a pretty good alibi. That is, if it's globalization and technological change, if it's computers and the internet, then presumably, all the countries that experience globalization, technological change, and the like would experience this kind of top-heavy hyper-inequality. And the answer, when you start to look across the world, you find that among rich democracies, the United States really stands out. We're the country that's seen the biggest increase in inequality, and the most top-heavy increase, the most concentrated increase at the top. I think the other side of our answer is, you know, we actually think there's not just strong circumstantial evidence, but sometimes really very direct evidence that public policy, what government did and didn't do, really played a big role in this. And I'll just give two quick examples. You mentioned financial deregulation. I think that's one that's really worth pointing out. It wasn't just that these titans of finance found out how to surf the new global currents. And it's also that they got very specific kind of advantages from public policy. Two economists looked at this and calculated that something like a third to half of the above-market earnings of Wall Street people, the degree to which they earned more than similarly educated and skilled people, was due to deregulation and government policy. And we think it's probably even higher than that when you start to really delve into it. The other area is tax policy. You know, over the same period in which the rich have pulled away, government has slashed tax rates on the richest of the rich. Warren Buffett, you know, recently said, you know, it's ridiculous that I pay such a low tax rate on my income. You know, I might even be paying a higher tax rate, he said, than my secretary. And the sort of extreme example of this is hedge fund managers who earn sometimes hundreds of millions and even billions of dollars. Many of them pay a 15% capital gains tax rate on a good chunk of their income because of this loophole in the tax code that is deliberately preserved. Because it showers so much largesse on such an influential group of donors to the parties.
It was preserved, I think, in this past year, actually. Preserved.
Yeah, we're what, 4 years into the Democratic, 4 years after the Democratic capture of Congress in 2006. We're about to see the end of that era. Uh-huh. And over that whole period, Democrats just couldn't get their act together, apparently, to fix this egregious loophole in the tax code that everyone knows to be
But that's the point. But that's the point, is that
right.
It's not, I mean, I think your book makes the argument that it's not a case of people getting their act together, that this is that this isn't a failure on the part necessarily of the Democrats to reverse this. This is baked into the cake. This is not
right.
necessarily a bug. This is, it is a growing feature of both political parties, and that's the part that is so disturbing and frankly depressing to me.
We should be careful not to say both parties are the same. The Republican Party has definitely gotten pulled more toward the money and more toward the right by these developments. But you're absolutely right; it's affected both parties and. It is depressing in the sense that we think that votes should really be the thing that matters, and yet it's between elections when the lobbyists are running the show and when this bipartisan pull toward the positions of the most organized, mobilized, and affluent members of society really shows itself.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the other primary argument of your book is that it's one thing to win elections, but at the end of the day, it is institutions and organizations that impact the decision making of the politicians that really is more determinant of I guess income disparity of income inequality, because they are the ones who are influencing the actual policies that will create, enhance, or diminish this disparity.
Yeah, I mean, one of the ways to think about this is that for voters, they have a pretty stark choice. They get to choose between parties and candidates that are put up to them by the parties and by organizations supporting them. And if both parties get pulled toward money, then that has a very fundamental effect on what that choice looks like. I mean, look at this last election. I think it's a great example. I mean, clearly Americans were really upset about the direction the government has been going, and they were overwhelmingly upset by their sense that it had gotten, the government was really responsive to Wall Street and big business and not the middle class. You know, the surveys suggested that most Americans felt like government was really looking out for those at the top and not those in the middle. And so that came down to a question of, you know, what do we do? And so we throw the bums out and we throw out the party that's in power, even if the party that's not in power, the Republican Party, has been basically playing a double game, you know, simultaneously railing against bailouts and also, you know, cozying up to industry lobbyists and particularly Wall Street to try to make sure that Wall Street gives to them in this fall's election. And the point is not that elections don't matter. They matter enormously. It's just that they're not the only thing that matters. And in particular, when you get beneath the kind of high-profile policy debates to the details of legislation, to how they get implemented, to what their effects are on the ground, to whether they get carried out at all, that's really when the lobbyists and the money matter. And, you know, that's where we're going to see the rubber meet the road on the financial industry regulations. It's where we're going to see the rubber meet the road on health care reform. And ironically, a lot of the compromises that had to be made to get these things through also made them even less attractive to most voters. So
right.
We really tell a story about how money and the rise of an organized business community transformed the Washington ecosystem, if you will, and with the result that both parties had to find, you know, a new niche. And the Republicans found the niche of the super conservative, business-friendly, anti-regulatory, you know, free market in name party. And the Democrats kind of cast about, and they basically threw, you know, they've got a kind of, you know, a pastiche of positions that represent, on the one hand, the fact that they're still the party of the little guy on a lot of issues. On the other hand, that they have to attract affluent, upper middle class folks who care more about environmentalism and some social issues than they do about these bread and butter economic issues. And then finally, they've got to get money. And the money really pulls them often towards the corporate position. So you have one party that on economic inequality is wearing a black hat. That's the Republican Party. There's no question about it. But it's not as if the Democrats are wearing white hats. They're kind of wearing gray hats. And, you know, every now and then the one or two of them, say Chuck Schumer on the hedge fund tax
right.
loophole, puts on the black hat because they have to defend their local economic interests.
Well, I mean, Jim Webb has come out recently and said that he was really shocked. One of the reasons why he became a Democrat as a lifelong sort of, I guess, somewhat apolitical, I think in his words, Republican, is that he saw the Democrats as standing up for the little guy, and he's been a little bit disillusioned. Now, let's go through the history of this, because it actually starts prior to the time, I think, when most people think that it would have started. It started during the late in the Carter administration in terms of how, I mean, you talk about a feedback loop here as corporations gained more power, as they decided to organize, to push their agenda, they gained more power and more ability to push that agenda. And it starts in 1978, 79.
Yeah, it's the forgotten, you know, 2 years of American politics, 78 and 79. I guess that if we think about, you know, any turning point in recent American politics, we think about 1980 as the great year of the Reagan Revolution. Maybe we think about 1968 and, you know, the fact that you know, Nixon sort of paved a new kind of culturally conservative strategy that brought in the Southern voters disillusioned with civil rights and the war on poverty. But we never think about 1978. And in fact, as we show, 78 is this crucial year. And that has two reasons why we focus on this period. It's not just this turns out to be the epicenter of the winner-take-all economy in many ways, the period in which the real sort of the tracks, the train switched tracks, but also because it's really revealing. This isn't a period in which we had a dramatic election. 1978 midterms were not ones that most people remember. Democrats had all two branches of government, in the sense they had both the House and both the Congress and the presidency. They had both houses of Congress, and yet 78 saw the defeat of labor law reform, actually really dramatic defeat through a filibuster that was waged by Senator Orrin Hatch, Republican of Utah, who had just entered the Senate. You saw the defeat of a number of other progressive bills, including a Consumer Protection Agency, including a minimum wage change, and you saw the defeat of, and this was probably the most consequential, you saw the defeat of Carter's more kind of progressive tax policies and their replacement with a series of big cuts on high-income taxes, including the first major cut in the capital gains tax that we saw in that period. So this really was a turning point. And it, since nothing happened on the sort of electoral front, The real story has to be understood as a reflection of what was going on in the business community. The business basically felt disadvantaged by the way in which politics had been going, and they organized on a broad scale. They were able to recruit candidates as well and really push new voices into Washington, and those voices were much more conservative. And that
do you think Reagan's electoral success in 1980 was also a function of the same forces that made these changes in 78 and 79?
I do, and I think that there's no question that there was a very big change in the governing agenda. I mean, Reagan, of course, came to power riding a wave of discontent with the economy. But I don't think those economic troubles would naturally have translated into the very specific policy agenda that Reagan pushed. And as we point out, this is true again and again. It's not as if there aren't grievances felt among voters. For example, the property tax revolt of the late 1970s was centered around a really big issue about the way in which property taxes were hitting voters very hard in this inflationary environment of the late 1970s. So too were voters worried about so-called bracket creep, right, where they were moving into higher income tax brackets because of inflation. So these were real grievances, but they were harnessed to push a much larger agenda that had to do with deregulation of business, cutbacks in the union rights, the slashing of taxes very specifically on high-income taxpayers, which were not the taxpayers, it should be noted, who were angry about the property tax hikes or bracket creep. Those were mostly middle and working class taxpayers.
Well, we're seeing the same thing in some respects with the Tea Party, aren't we? I mean, is that a phenomena that may exist, but otherwise without the influence of literally tens of millions of maybe hundreds of millions of corporate dollars of corporate money increases its, I guess, its impact.
Yeah, I think that's it's very hard to understand the fixation of Republican leaders on the high-end tax cuts, the extension of the high-end tax cuts, which are really only of benefit to the very richest Americans. You know, millionaires and above will receive very large tax cuts from extending all the Bush tax cuts, not just the middle class ones.
With data supporting the fact that they don't create jobs.
There are very few small businesses that are going to be positively affected by extension of these upper income tax cuts. I mean, we had a big experiment in the 2000 period after the tax cuts in whether high-end tax cuts boost employment, and the answer was pretty unequivocally that no, that they do not. That there's no debate among economists that the tax cuts for the rich are the least efficient way of boosting jobs. The real reason why those have become the sort of guiding light of the Republican Party, it seems to me, is because of where the party gets its money and because of the long-term development of the party ideology in pursuit of and solidification of this business Republican alliance. So the point is that, you know, politics plays out through it plays out on this stage of electoral politics frequently. You know, every 2 years we have these big spectacular battles, but there are these long-term shifts in the structure of our politics and our parties, and we tell the story of how those long-term shifts have basically tilted the playing field away from the middle class, away from middle-class organizations, and in favor of those at the top and those political figures and parties that are most capable of benefiting from this new, you know, this new economic and political world.
I know we have to go shortly. I have two questions. One is, I think maybe my audience is not aware, but your health care reform proposal essentially became the proposal of all of the top three candidates, more or less, in the Democratic primary. And your proposals were in some ways the foundation for the health care reform that we got. One of the big elements of it, and maybe I'm overstating it from your perspective, was the public option. Now, I know you supported health care reform. Ultimately, you came to support it without the public option, and I know how much you fought to try and maintain it. But do you see the loss of the public option in the context of health care reform as another piece of this broader narrative of how corporate interests have impacted our policy making.
Oh yes, I mean I'm writing this book as I'm engaged in this grand healthcare fight, and it's I guess it was sort of a way of consoling myself because the forces I was up against were so big. But we were seeing, we meaning the people who were alongside me, struggling to try to preserve a robust public plan that would compete with private insurance, and you know, we're seeing today just how important that is as prices are skyrocketing upwards, and we see more and more consolidation of both the insurance and the provider sides of healthcare, you know, so that costs, I think, are really the big threat over the long term for this healthcare plan. You know, the conservative attacks are one thing, but if we can't control costs, then, you know, we really can't deliver on the promise of healthcare reform. So, yeah, I mean, when I was fighting on this, the degree to which it was just an uphill battle fighting really intense organized interests was came home to me every day. And I would say that, I think more generally that the Obama presidency, the great problem that it faced in its first 2 years was really that Obama came in promising transformative change, but to get things done, he and his aides basically decided that they had to try to work within the existing system, that they couldn't put reform of it on the front burner, but instead they really had to try to engage in what Paul Pearson and I call in the book, organized combat. So they brought in the sort of congressionalists, the people who had been working with Congress before, Rahm Emanuel chief among them, and they tried to kind of cut all the deals. They cut a deal with the hospital industry that may well have precluded the public option just from the outset. So they cut all these high-profile, high-stakes, high-cost deals to get the bill through. And what they ended up doing was creating a bill that didn't have a lot of enthusiasm. Now, was there another route? You know, that's the hard question. But as I lived through it, I saw again and again that the world of winner-take-all politics was really constraining what the administration wanted to do and what I could do.
This is a subsidiary bonus question for me, so forgive me. But I mean, do you perceive it as the inability of the Obama administration to fulfill its promise of change is one of making a decision early on simply to be pragmatic, or do you think that in the final analysis the perception of change is that the Obama administration, that Obama himself has, I mean, it's impossible to read someone's mind, is less than maybe the rest of us perceive, or the need for it, or the type of change?
Well, I think it's a combination of the two. And on policy issues, I think that there was a tendency for supporters of the president to assume that he was, you know, closer to them, supporters of the president on the left, to assume he was closer to them than he might have been. But I think that there is also a huge amount, there was a huge amount of pragmatic concessions that were made. And I think the biggest area of that, since I believe that the president sincerely came in thinking that Washington had to change, was basically saying, we're not going to push back against the way the system works. We're going to work within it rather than try to work, to change it. And I think that cost the president very dearly. I think that if you look at the backlash against his presidency, it's fundamentally rooted in a sense that, you know, that Washington doesn't work, and it doesn't work in a very particular way, not the way that a lot of the conservative critics say, because they tend to focus on spending or the deficit alone as if these are not, for most people, symptoms of deeper problems. The deeper problem is people think that Washington isn't responsive to the middle class. And I think by pursuing a kind of inside strategy and not really using the power of his rhetoric and his inspiration, the president fed into that critique. And so to me, that's the great question isn't whether the president couldn't have avoided midterm losses. There's no question that given where the economy was and was going to be, even with more aggressive measures to restore it, and given that it was a midterm election where presidents almost always lose seats, that he was going to face some losses. But the scale of that loss, I think, was avoidable and rested in substantial part on this decision to sort of focus on the inside game. You know, we can't rerun history, so I don't know if we're right. But I think...
Not to mention the damage that we've done in terms of a missed opportunity to espouse certain values and a framework for policies in the future.
That's right. And this is a huge missed opportunity. I mean, I think the way to understand what's happened over the last few years is to say, look, we came in to this recession with already 15 or 20 years of severe neglect of basic economic problems facing the middle class, whether it was declining health insurance, whether it was growing gap between the middle and the top, whether it was the fact that we had seen some of the wellsprings of opportunity, like the opportunity to go to college or move up the income ladder, stagnate. All these areas, you know, were present even before the Great Recession. But then the Great Recession kind of made it undeniable that there were these deep problems within our society. But, you know, 2 years, 3 years out, we're facing a debate in which we could have deficit reduction and kind of cutting government dominate while the millions of Americans still remain out of work. And, you know, if there was any way to avoid that, then it's a great missed opportunity that it wasn't avoided.
Let me just one final. How do we combat this? I mean, if from an electoral standpoint, it's not enough to elect record-breaking majorities in the House and the Senate, or close to it anyways, and in Democratic control, how does the middle class, what do we need to do to influence this debate?
Well, it would be nice to think that there was some kind of easy answer, and there isn't. I think that we should divide this into a sort of medium and long term. In the medium term, I think that political reform is essential in making the case for political reform. I mean, remember that the one thing that I think seemed really striking over this last couple of years is that whenever the president and his staff believed that they couldn't achieve a goal, they decided to take it off the agenda. But fighting for things that are not achievable in the near term is often really good politics. Yes. And good policy.
Yes.
And so now that the president really has no prospect of achieving many of the things he believes in, I hope that he'll swing a little bit more for the bleachers. So making the case and having reform forces talking about these issues in a variety of forums is very crucial in the sort of immediate term. Over the longer term, I think it's going to take revival of what Paul Pearson and I and Winner Take All Politics call middle class democracy, and that's really a strong set of organizations that bring middle class Americans into politics. And I would say that the Tea Party actually offers a little bit of a reason for optimism here. I mean, here is a very networked, technologically savvy movement that has attracted a very intense but broad-based group of Americans to engage in politics. It's harder, of course, to engage those whose views are not as extreme. But I mean, one of the features of the last 15 years or so is the ability of to bring in more voices into politics, both through technology and through, I think, through a kind of more of an emphasis on accountability of politicians in office for what they do through these media, both the internet and through a rise of new organizational tools for those who are trying to build movements. And so it's just a difficult task. It's going to be a long slog, but it seems to me that we now know what the challenge is, and it's really to revive that kind of broad middle class organization on new technological foundations.
Jacob Hacker, co-author of Winner Take All Politics with Paul Pearson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on, Sam.
We'll talk to you soon. Thank you again. So next up, an interview with Kevin Drum. He is a writer for the Washington Monthly. He had a great piece on the plutocracy, and it's an interview I did for Ring of Fire. But it was it's an excellent interview, and if you didn't hear it, this one's a pretty important one. It gives a really good sense of the history of how we've gotten to this point where unions have. Unions are no longer receiving the support from the Democratic Party that they need to continue, and as such, the Democratic Party has lost a lot of support. So here's that interview with Kevin Drum now. So, Kevin, in your piece, Plutocracy Now, you know, you're talking about themes that I'm seeing talked about a lot, that we have such incredible, not just income distribution or I guess a difference in a disparity in income distribution in this country, but we're also seeing the same in terms of the same disparity in terms of political power. And your piece outlines it. So let's just walk through this. I think we don't need to reiterate that there were expectations for Obama and a Democratic House and Senate that at least progressives feel were not met in terms of fundamentally changing the way that the super rich in this country and the corporations have so much seemingly control over the decisions in our society. So walk us through this. There are two things you start off that are crucial to understand about American politics.
There are. You know, one of them, when you talk about income inequality, a lot of people sort of think about income inequality being between, say, the upper middle class and the lower middle class. And that's really not where the big change has come. The big change has come in the very, very top, the top 1%, which has just run away from everybody, even the upper middle class. They've run away from. So pretty much all the money, all the extra money, so to speak, that the country has generated over the last 30 years as the economy has grown, almost all of it, maybe two-thirds of it, has gone to that top 1%. So that's what's generated a huge amount of income inequality. And then the other thing I pointed out is that there's a growing body of academic research that says that basically Congress and the president really don't respond to anybody other than pretty much the upper middle class and the rich. If you look at evidence about what the poor, what the policy preferences of the poor are, the policy preferences of the lower middle class, and even the middle class, it turns out that Congress hardly reacts to that at all.
And we're talking about the vast majority of people. I mean,
yes,
we're talking about
upwards of 80% of the people.
Right. So congressional decision making is driven not necessarily even by those who voted for them as much as it is by the wealthy, and whatever the mechanics of that are, you know, we're not necessarily dealing with that, but that's the reality of it.
That's right. It's driven by the upper middle class and the rich almost exclusively. And you know, what I was trying to get at in my piece was, why is that? I mean, it hasn't always been that way. And so what is it that changed? And I think that what changed is that in the past, we had private sector labor unions who were a very big, very influential, very powerful set of organizations that represented not just their own members, but it turns out really represented the interests of the working class and the middle class writ large. And that's disappeared.
And we should talk about this, you know, in terms of the problems that this both economic disparity and this political disparity represent are that, one, from an economic standpoint, from a political standpoint, we see it across the board, right? I mean, our taxes are, as a percentage of GDP, are lower than they've been probably in about 60 years. Anybody making over $1 million is probably paying an ineffective tax almost 20 percentage points lower than they would have 60 years ago, 50 years ago. And it's corrosive to democracy, too, isn't it?
Yes, it absolutely is. And if you want what I think is an even better example, is just take a look at the last couple of years. I mean, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, in 2008, the financial industry, Wall Street, literally within a hair's breadth of destroying the world. I mean, I don't think it's an overstatement to say that. And yet, what's happened to them? Virtually nothing. Their profits are back, have bounced back. Bonuses are back to what they were back in 2007. You know, the Dodd-Frank bill is a very, very weak set of regulations. They've gotten off almost completely scot-free. And you got to ask yourself, how can an industry, how can a set of people do that and somehow pay virtually no price?
Yeah, and I would even maybe argue that contrary to even paying no price, we have a bigger problem in terms of too big to fail, because these banks are actually bigger now. And we have basically trained them. Our government has basically said, hey, you know how there may have been some type of moral hazard there, and that we sort of gave you the notion that we would never let you fail? Well, now we've doubled down on that. So we're almost encouraging that behavior again.
Yes, I think you're right about that. There is something to that. And, you know, there are things we could have done about that. And we did a little bit of it, but almost nothing. I mean, you know, I was reading just the other day that Jamie Dimon was complaining about the increased regulation of banks, and I just had to laugh. I mean, his bank wasn't the worst of the bunch, but still, I mean, the regulations that have been put in place are just minuscule. I mean, very small changes in capital requirements, some fairly weak regulations on derivatives exchanges and things like that. His bank is going to be as big and as profitable, as you say, bigger, and maybe more profitable than it was before 2008.
Right. And he's the CEO. We should just say he's the CEO of Chase, of J.P. Yes. Morgan Chase.
Right.
So we have this situation where it's clearly it's been bad for the economy. If you measure what is good for the economy as being good for the vast majority of people, we have 30 years of stagnant wages. The only people, like you say, the only people who have like accrued wealth at a significant click has been this upper 1%. We have taxes on these people at sort of historic lows. When did this start happening, and what happened?
Well, I think what happened, this was, the article that I wrote was I owed a big debt to a book called Winner Take All Politics by Jacob Hacker and Paul Pierce. And here's what they say. They say if you look at income inequality, you can sort of break it up into two things. One is there are economic trends happening in the world that are driving some economic inequality. Okay, so that's one side of it. But that's not the whole story. The other side of the story is that a lot of income inequality is driven by politics. There are political decisions that are made, laws passed, agency rulings, and so forth, that are made that can either fight against this trend of income inequality or can make it worse. What they say is that to a large extent, over the last 30 years, politics has made it worse. And where I took that was, you know, there's a lot of reasons for that. There's a lot of politics involved, but I think one of the big, big factors is that in the 30 years after World War II, you had private sector labor unions, which were a big, powerful force institutionally. And when I say that, I mean, it's somebody that politicians had to pay attention to. And they were fighting for the middle class. And then starting around in the late 70s, and this is a story I tell in my piece, private sector labor unions started to decline badly. And they kept declining through the 80s and through the 90s. And today, they're just a shadow for themselves. And so there's nobody left. There are voters. Right? There are a lot of middle-class voters, working-class voters. But politicians don't pay attention to voters. They pay attention to big institutional groups that can give them money, that can affect their future. And for the middle class, that doesn't exist anymore. Labor unions just aren't strong enough to do that. Whereas on the other side of the story, there are plenty of institutions left that represent big corporations, that represent the rich, that represent the financial industry. It's been completely one-sided for the last 30 years.
We've got to take a break, Kevin, but when we come back, let's talk about how we lost, and by we, I mean essentially those of us in the 80-90 percentile of this kind, you know, the 80-90 percent whose political agenda and aspirations are not being pursued by the establishment. Let's talk about how that happened. It's actually, I think your assessment is going to be surprising to people, and we'll be right back to talk about that. So, Kevin, when we broke, we were talking about how unions, which had represented sort of the aspirations of all working class people, whether they were unionized or not, have lost their influence as an establishment. How did that happen? When did that first? They were a big, big institutional constituency of the Democratic Party and the left. When did that begin to fall apart?
Well, it started to fall apart, I think, largely in the late 60s. And, you know, the story I tell is that, you know, what happened is that The new left that rose in the 60s was not basically concerned with economic issues. They were concerned with the Vietnam War. They were concerned with feminism. They were concerned with civil rights, environmentalism, social issues, and non-economic issues for the most part. It just wasn't what animated them. And that drove a huge split in the Democratic Party. We saw that in 1968 in the Chicago convention, and then we saw it again in 1972 when George McGovern was nominated, and that's when the split really, really hit home. You had this old line, old left of big labor leaders who hated the new left, and the feeling was completely mutual. The new left considered labor leaders to be just a bunch of old line, middle-aged white guys, anti-communist white guys. And the labor leaders thought that the new left was just a bunch of women and shaggy-haired professors and gays, and they had no use for them. And that drove a huge split in the Democratic Party, and a lot of liberal energy went into those social issues and started moving away from economic issues.
So there was you're describing a cultural cleave here between those two parties.
Yes, very much. And that's changed, I mean, more recently. I mean, what I'm describing doesn't exist as much or even at all, hardly, today. But it did. In the late 60s and early to mid-70s, it absolutely did. And one of the things you have to understand about unions is that they can only exist, they can only thrive, if they have government support. I mean, it's just absolutely critical that you have a legal regime that supports unions. And to do that, you need a party that supports unions.
We should say that the same dynamic exists for corporations. I mean, if you don't have a legal framework for corporations, they also can't exist. Neither one of these things exists. And that's what started to happen, is that legal framework and the protection and the support for that legal framework started to diminish.
Yes, I think that's true. I think I'd argue that it's far more true of unions than it is of corporations.
Uh-huh.
But regardless, you're right. And the legal regime, like I said, requires government support, and therefore requires support of a major political party. So when the Democratic Party gets split, its support for unions starts to decline. And, of course, union support was critical for Democratic Party power. And so it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. One side declines, the other side declines. Unions decline, the party declines. Unions decline, the party declines some more. And, you know, by the early 90s, by the time everybody had sort of figured out what was really happening, it was too late. Private sector unions, which had once represented, 30% of the workers in the country, were down to about 10%. And today, of course, it's down to about 7%. I mean, they've become tiny.
And the solution from the Democratic Party was, at this point, was to simply say, okay, unions are not what they were because we have institutionally not supported them in the way that they need their support to exist. And so they no longer can support us from an electoral standpoint. So what we need to do is get corporate money, and then we have the DLC.
Right. That's exactly right. And you can see that, as this plays out, there's almost no choice. Once that split happens in the Democratic Party, once support for unions starts to wane, Democrats, by the mid-80s, they almost don't have any choice, right? I mean, a big party has to have money and has to have influence to survive, and there's only just so many places that you can get that. And once union support started to decline, with the eager help of the Republican Party, obviously, then Democrats had to look elsewhere. And the elsewhere they looked was big corporations. And, they did not become sort of the handmaiden of big corporations that the Republican Party has always been, but they went about halfway there.
Right.
And so you have a really split party. They're not slaves of corporations, but, boy, they sure don't want to do much of anything to make them angry either.
Right. They may not be slaves, but they're certainly working for them in some regard, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
So basically what you're talking about is the story that in some way, in the late 60s, unions were almost victims of their own success because they had created a working class and an upper middle class that felt financially secure. So much so that they were no longer animated by these issues that unions had traditionally fought for.
The unions themselves were still animated by that. But, I mean, if I can put it a different way, I might say that maybe the sons and daughters
right.
of those union members weren't. Because, you know, as the Port Huron statement said so famously, they were the sons and daughters who had been born in at least moderately comfortable circumstances. And so you're right, they weren't, it didn't seem as important to them growing up in the 60s, growing up the way they did. And of course the unions, you know, bear a huge amount of blame for this themselves. I mean, they were, to a large extent, they were lazy about trying to broaden their influence.
Mm-hmm.
And they also, you know, spent way too much time fighting the new left and fighting the social movements of the 60s. And that helped bring them down.
All right. We have just a very brief amount of time left. But one of the things I noticed when I was in Madison a couple of weeks ago was that you had people who were teachers' assistants at University of Madison who were the first people to be out there protesting and were joined ultimately by these same very sort of like blue-collar, hardcore union guys. And they were protesting at the same moment. Do you think that we're starting to see the beginnings of a return to an understanding by both of those two different parties, and particularly now that those social issues have all basically, or not all, been completely resolved, but certainly are not as contentious as they were? Are we starting to see a fusion or between those concerns again, around those concerns?
Well, I think we are. I think unfortunately, it's probably too late. I think it's too late to expect that the union movement is really going to, you know, to ever become close to what it used to be. But yeah, I think people are. I think you are seeing that. At the very least, people don't want it to get any worse. They don't want to see unions destroyed any further than they have been. It's only too bad this didn't happen 20 or 30 years ago instead of right now.
Well, I got to tell you, Kevin, I hold out just a little bit more hope, because one of the things I really noticed in Madison is that, as much as that it's perceived as a union action there, it was really, in many respects, a labor action. And I don't know if what we will come out of that will be stronger unions, but I think to a certain extent, we're going to see people start to congeal around these issues in a way that may, down the road, lead to that more union support. But I guess time will tell.
Sticks and stones may break his bones, but conservative lies will only make him stronger. Sam Cedar.
Hey, everybody, it's Matt again. Up next is a slew of best of clips. Actually, Sam has no idea how many best ofs I've given you today. I was just rummaging through all of these best of clips that were picked by us along with Jay from the Best of the Left, and I noticed a theme throughout. Some of the best Majority Report segments come from when Sam is taking down mainstream media and right-wing TV and radio lies. So I've put together a compilation of the Majority Report's takedown of everyone from Glenn Beck to Fox News, and some especially awesome segments from Sam talking about the News Corp hacking scandal.
I'm not as plugged in as, say, like, you know, like they are on CNN. I'm not providing the enormous quality of in-depth analysis of our news like they are in CNN. I mean, I imagine they're going to cover the poll that I'm talking about, which is proof positive that while you folks may be somewhat elite and exclusive in your understanding of politics, at the end of the day, your agenda is no different than the vast majority of Americans who want to see us tax the rich. I'll get to that poll in a second. But my point being, we just don't have the capacity to do the type of in-depth reporting and the smart, intelligent work they're doing in places like CNN, for instance. You know, yesterday I mentioned this story about the couple of thousand birds that fell from the sky in Beebe, Arkansas. And the wildlife officials there, they are working under the assumption there was some type of traumatic event like upper altitude hail or a thunderstorm. And then there was a report that there were thousands of dead fish in another part of Arkansas, which it looks more like some type of poisoning. And I guess I just do not have the analytical skills that one would need to be on broadcast, I should say, cablecast, mainstream television. We don't have the capacity here to do the type of analysis and news reporting that they have there. We simply don't. And case in point, this story, which I mentioned, I reported on yesterday, but I didn't put two and two together. No, for that, you need CNN. Roll tape, please.
It's really terrible. As if the Arkansas bird drop weren't freakish enough, it came on the heels of a massive fish kill 125 miles away. Tens of thousands of dead fish washed up on the shores of the Arkansas River near Ozark last Thursday. While wildlife experts say the two events are almost certainly unrelated, it's certainly an odd coincidence. The internet, of course, is now buzzing with other theories. Some people even saying this is a
stop it there. Now, of course, there experts are saying they're almost certainly unrelated. Slow news day. What can we do? Let's go on the internet and see what we can find.
Some people even saying this is these math deaths are a sign that the end times are near. Some have cited the Left Behind series of books. So we thought we'd talk to actor Kirk Cameron. He's a born-again Christian. He's written a lot about his faith. He also starred in the Left Behind series of films. I spoke to him earlier. Kirk, there's a lot of chatter out there on the internet about these thousands of birds and fish dying. Some people saying this is a sign of the end of days. You obviously starred in a series of films sort of based on the idea of the Left Behind series. When you hear that, what do you think?
Well, I first think that they ought to call a veterinarian, not me. You know, I'm not the religious conspiracy theorist go-to guy particularly. But I think it's really kind of silly to try to equate birds falling out of the sky with some kind of an end times theory.
Hey, what happened?
Yeah, hey, what happened? Do you know that there is probably nothing more embarrassing than being on national television and having Kirk Cameron, the man who starred in a YouTube video, showing us a banana as proof that evolution doesn't exist, tell you that it's pretty silly to have me on your program to discuss this. My God. And I love how Anderson Cooper had to leapfrog. Well, most experts agree this has not even related. However, we went to the internet. On the internet, there's some people who are crazy, and crazy people mentioned Kirk Cameron, so here he is. And then Kirk Cameron, when Kirk Cameron is the voice of reason, folks, when Kirk Cameron is telling mainstream media, hey, look, you know, I got to say, you're really pushing it here. But let me show you this banana as proof that there's no evolution. What an embarrassment. So here we go. Fox and Friends covering the News Corp scandal, which now is being investigated by the FBI, the Department of Justice. It's being investigated by the British Parliament. You've just had the Rebecca Brooks, who is a top official in News Corp, just resign. And here is Fox and Friends weighing in on this.
For the first time.
First time ever.
Joining us right now is a man who knows about the media, Bob Dylan Schneider, the head of the New York-based Dylan Schneider Group, and he used to run one of the biggest PR firms in the country. Good morning to you, Bob.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
Fine, thank you very much. What do you make of this particular hacking scandal with the News of the World?
Well, the News of the World is a hacking scandal. It can't be denied. But the issue really is, why are so many people piling on at this point? We know it's a hacking scandal. Shouldn't we get beyond it and really deal with the issue of hacking? I mean, Citicorp has been hacked into, Bank of America has been hacked into, American Express has been hacked into, insurance companies have been hacked into. We've got a serious hacking problem in this country. And
Wait a second.
24,000 files. So we've got to figure out a way to deal with this hacking problem. That's what we have to do.
You know,
Wait. This is a hacking problem? You've got these companies have been hacked into. Why aren't we talking about hacking in general? News Corp is doing the hacking. There's a difference between, like, it's like saying, like, look, yes, I know this guy is a murderer. He killed people, but people are dying. Let's talk about the issue of people dying. There are people dying everywhere. There have been people hit by a bus. There have been people hit by a car. There's been other people who've been killed by murderers. Why are we talking about this one murderer? We should be talking about the idea of murdering. That's the problem. The problem isn't this murderer. The problem is murdering.
It's the worst PR firm I've ever heard.
No, well, I am willing to bet. I am willing to bet that this guy does PR.
We've got a
for
serious
Newscorp
hacking problem in this country, and this morning the government's obviously been hacked too,
right,
and over 24,000 files. So we've got to figure out a way to deal with this hacking problem. That's
sure
what we have to do.
You know, and
they are the hacking problem.
And they said, "Look, this happened a long time ago, at a tabloid in London. Somebody did something really bad, and the company reacted. They closed that newspaper." All those people got fired, even though 99% of them absolutely had nothing to do with it.
And if I'm not mistaken, Murdoch, who owns it, has apologized. But for some reason, the public, the media, keeps going over this again and again and
the
again.
Piling on.
It's a little bit too much. But I think the bigger
issue
is really
the news
hacking, and how are we as a public going to protect ourselves and protect our privacy and deal with it. And I would also say, by the way, Citigroup. Great bank. Bank of America.
Privacy?
Great bank. Are they getting the same kind of attention for hacking that took place less than a year ago that News Corp is getting today?
Right. And then you, along those lines, you've got the news about this thing at the Pentagon. I mean, it sounds like the country of China, yeah, who we owe a whole bunch of debt
to. Chinese,
you know
what's happening here?
Pentagon supercomputer.
You know what's happening here is that Steve Doocy, or whatever his name is. Is this Doocy or the other one? Is this douchey or douchebaggery? I can't tell which guy it is who's speaking here. This guy is so shocked. Like clearly, the producer told either this guy, Dylan Schneider, doesn't know the story, or is being so brazen in his attempt to conflate the story that Doocy over here is looking back and just going like, I don't know how to continue with the, you've gone miles beyond where I thought we could do to cloud this thing. China. What about China? It's like China over here.
Surprised he didn't go Ground Zero Musk.
And sucked out 24,000 different files. Where is that as a big story?
It's really very, very scary. And I think that we should be very concerned as a public about our privacy and about people getting access to what we have. And we've got...
Well, here. This is how you can start with as the public. Stop the news organization that has been professionally hacking thousands. They have admitted to hacking 4,000 voicemails, at least.
We've got to find ways to defend ourselves.
Sure. And one of the other things about...
The first thing you can do to defend yourself, close News Corp down. That would be the first thing you can do.
Media piling on and... You know, you look at some sites, you would think that Martians had landed in New Jersey again. We've got some serious problems in this country right now. We are teetering
on
default.
There are people, there's Martians landing in New Jersey.
In government-funded helicopters.
The name of this segment was like, can we actually see, this is like one of those things where the producers are like drunk, like at like midnight last night. They're drunk, they're high, and they're going, dude, do you think we could actually do a segment which made it sound like News Corp was the victim of hacking? Come on! I don't know, I'm going to type it up right now! And then they were too fucked up, and they forgot that they left it in the computer system, and then someone picked it up the next morning. Hold on, I'm going to keep playing this. Let's see here.
Problems in this country right now. We are teetering on default. And what do? They talk about this.
We've got major problems in the country. John Boehner's dealing with tough problems. The president's dealing with tough problems. We have problems in the states. And we're dealing with this issue over in London that took place more than a decade ago.
Sure.
I don't quite understand it.
And Mr. Murdoch himself has said that he's going to cooperate. He's going to show up at Parliament next
week. Why
is
he cooperating?
And,
how can he do this when we're so close to default?
Who headed up that unit is calling it quits.
All the right things have been done from a crisis point of view in terms of this News of the World issue. It really should get put behind us. Investigators, the court should deal with this, and we should move on and deal with the important topics of the day.
I think you're right. All right, Bob Dylan Schneider.
Good to see you.
Pleasure to see you right
always
here on the big desk.
Always a good. Thank you.
Pleasure to see you right here.
I don't think so.
There you have it. That is stunning. That is stunning.
But you know what? It's their demographic is totally listening and not understanding. They're just hearing hacking everywhere.
Hacking? What's going on? We're all being hacked. Oh, my gosh. How come nobody's talking about Citigroup? Unbelievable. That is
fantastic.
Bob Dylan Schneider, I hope he got paid well for that. It's going to, I guarantee you, by Monday, we're going to find out that he's either being paid by News Corp or he's like he's dating Steve Ducey's daughter or something. Let's play Screaming Majority's Murdoch on the Line. This is a great one, folks. Another great one from Screaming Majority. This is our recap of the week. And, of course, the Murdoch story, a huge story. I don't think this one's going to go away for a long time. Here is David Ben-Joya and his Screaming Majority.
Try to call you, baby. I want to make you mine. Each time I call you, baby, I get Rupert Murdoch on the line. Need to hear your sweet voice, ease my worried psyche. Each time I hear,
what's all this noise? Wallabies, crikey, pigeon woo, that's not news. Don't you have a dead relative or two?
Try to call you, baby, I tell you you're so fine. Each time I call you, baby, I get Rupert Murdoch on the line.
50 large pizza pies with extra Vegemite. Send them to the BBC. Hold on. I've got a call on the other line.
Hello, Ruth. David Cameron here. Got any dirt on my political enemies?
Well, the former Prime Minister has a young son. The boy is very, very sick.
Why, that's wonderful. But word's gotten out that you've been hacking phones, and some of the sticklers have got their knickers in a bunch.
Oh, no. The jiggeroo's gone buggeroo.
Try to call you, baby. Tell you that I'm dying.
That's more like it.
Each time I call you, baby, I get Rupert Murdoch on the line.
Stop the presses. No, seriously, stop them. We've been busted. We're shutting down. Prince dead anyway.
Rupert Murdoch on the line. Rupert Murdoch on the line. Rupert Murdoch on the line.
We were about to queue up the... this interview from that I recorded from the other day from with Van Jones, but just received a phone call. I'm sorry, sir. Could you tell me your name again?
Rupert Murdoch.
Okay, Mr. Murdoch, have you been? I got to ask why you're calling the program. I've been talking about the problems that News Corp has been having. Are you a regular listener of the program?
I am a regular listener, Sammy. I do have a question for you.
What is that? What is that?
Is your phone number 917-553-3800?
No.
It's not his. It's not his number.
All right. Well,
sorry. What were we talking about?
Now that I have you on the line, sir, I want to ask you just a couple of questions here. Your son, James, looks like he could actually be in some legal jeopardy with
James. Is it James? Let me say one thing about James.
All right.
He's a pussy.
It's your own son. I don't know. I mean, is that really that appropriate to say about your...
It's the truth, Sammy. He's a pussy. He's always been a pussy. His mother made him into a faggot. I mean, he's just a pussy.
I don't know how to really respond to that. Well, I guess, I don't really know. I mean, you know, listen, dad's sons, maybe I don't want to go into that area, but I have
No. I should have given everything to Elizabeth. She's got bigger balls than James and Lachlan combined, and I've seen them. They're huge. She was born with them, Sam.
Your daughter was born with testicles. All right. Well, I mean, I can appreciate that. I mean, but
they're gigantic, Sam. They're gigantic.
No, I'm sure. I'm sure. I don't mean in any way to diminish the size.
I've never made a mistake, and that's the one mistake I have made. That's the one.
You
should have given everything to Elizabeth. I shouldn't have given it to that pussy James. And I shouldn't have given it to anything to Lachlan, who's betrayed me. He's betrayed me, Sam.
Well, listen. I have problems with my own child. I can appreciate that this must be a difficult.
You have no idea. You have no. You are not a Murdoch. You don't have the print business in your blood, Sam. You don't. You just don't. You can't. It's a Murdoch blood.
Well, it's true. I'm not a Murdoch.
And let's talk about the situation right now. I'm in London, as you know. I'm out in Wapping.
All right. Well, you're in London. I got to ask you, the news today is that it just came out that News Corp is buying back $5 billion in stock. This is a day after you lost $7 billion in market capitalization yesterday. You had a one-day drop of 7.6%. Is this the end of your empire?
Possibly. Maybe. I'm not sure yet.
Wow. Well, you certainly seem to be taking the news well. I mean, why would you laugh about that? I mean, isn't that a little bit scary? I mean, how do you account for this? Is it just simply people reacting to the fact that the empire could be over now? You sold News of the World. The Sun could be in jeopardy. It looks like this broadcast, the B-Sky-B purchase is not going to happen. I mean, you could all end up in jail, frankly.
No. I'll tell you one problem. I pinpointed it, Sam. I had a long flight from Los Angeles, actually via Sun Valley, Idaho, over here to Wapping outside of London.
Okay.
And it became very clear to me about just as I passed New York.
Right? In this.
And it's
sky.
The Jews, Sam. The Jews are setting me up here. We've done no wrong.
The Jews.
Yes, James is a pussy, but that has nothing to do with this. The fact of the matter is we've done no wrong.
Well, I mean, you hacked
it
into...
is the Jews. Jews have always wanted to get me. They've always wanted to get me, Sam.
Well, I mean...
You know this.
Well, personally speaking, this Jew, I'm going to cop to it a little bit. I mean, I'm...
That's why I'm calling you. I'm calling you, the king of the Jews, to tell you. But the Jews are out for... They're out for me. And
I'm actually not the king. I'm actually, to be honest with you, I'm a duke. I'm a duke of the Jews. I'm not quite the king.
Whatever silly names you people call yourselves, fine.
Well, I mean, you can't simply say this is about the Jews. I mean, because, of course, I mean, this is about your hacking, your company breaking the law, hacking into voicemails, attempting to try and hack into the voicemails of 9/11 victims, spying on people. I mean, it has nothing to do with the Jews, does it?
It has everything to do with the Jews. I'm not quite sure what your problem. I don't understand your point.
Well, it just can't possibly just be the Jews here. It has to do with your behavior.
Oh yeah, no. I. There are other people here. This is not about my behavior. We have rooted out the bad apples here, Sam.
Who are the bad apples?
Rooted them out. Glenn Beck, who's working very closely with the Jews.
Well, Glenn.
Is very upset that I'm sorry.
Please. Glenn Beck is responsible of this. And he is, well, I mean, he is in Israel. I guess he just addressed the Knesset.
He's in Israel. He will be. He's either there or he's going to be there soon, Sam. I don't follow the man. I don't give a shit about him.
All right, so you're saying
he's another fucking pussy.
Okay, so it's Glenn Beck and the Jews are responsible for
together,
this.
Together,
and that's it. There's no other reason possible why this.
Well,
could be...
If I were to be completely honest with you, and I feel I have been.
Well, I think that you certainly have probably said what you think is the truth.
All right, if you want to play that way. It's also those damn kids from Dino 210 for growing up and getting ugly and fat.
It's the kids from 90210. They were
so cute when they were young.
It's true. I guess so. The reason why your company has lost... Let me just sum this up here. The reason why...
Hang on. I said that wasn't the number, James. Try another number. Yeah, go ahead.
The reason why News Corp has lost 7.6 percent to $7 billion in market capitalization.
Three very obvious reasons.
Jews, Glenn Beck, and the kids from 90210 for growing old.
Yeah, and the little fat fucks from 90210. Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm glad to give you your opportunity to speak to this. I got to ask you one more question. What are you Scottish? What happened to your... All right, well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Mr. Murdoch. I appreciate you calling in.
No problem, Sam. No problem.
Hey. Wow, I actually got Murdoch to be speechless. Let's listen. This is him on going on with Stuart Varney the other day. And Stuart Varney wanted to talk about it, but apparently in this age of complete transparency, Rupert Murdoch didn't want to say anything. And remember, Rupert Murdoch is Stuart Varney's boss.
Mr. Chairman, thanks very much for joining us. We appreciate it, sir.
Fine. Good afternoon.
The story that is really buzzing all around the country, and certainly here in New York, is that the News of the World, a News Corporation newspaper in Britain, used...
I'm not talking about that issue at all today. Sorry.
Okay. No worries, Mr. Chairman. That's fine with me.
I'm too far removed. I'm out of here.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
That's all right, sir. I'm sorry.
I'm not a real journalist.
Quiet, man! Don't say anything. Stop the laughter! Everyone! I'm sorry, sir. Sorry, sir. I didn't mean to. Please don't. Holy cow. Okay. Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. This is Glenn Beck. You know, here's the thing. When you move off of television and you're in a locked... sort of a dungeon like he is with his Glenn Beck show now on TV. It's web. I don't know if you can get any of it for free. I don't think so. I think you have to be a member to get any of it. It's not as democratic as this.
Well, it's Glenn Beck.
It's Glenn Beck. Now, of course, he's on radio, but what this guy has to do now is he's going to have to get even more spectacularly offensive. This is Glenn Beck on the shooting that took place in Oslo by this right-wing fanatic who shares many, if not 100%, of Glenn Beck's intellectual infrastructure. They both draw from the exact same well. But Glenn Beck manages to slag the camp, the youth camp for future leaders of the Labor Party, and here he does. Here it is.
So, Saturday, I was following the news of the shooting in Norway and the explosion in Norway, which happened, what, on Friday?
Yeah, the explosion was, and then we left the air, and
right.
And then he went to, the camp.
Yeah, well, when we heard the explosion, everybody was willing to say, it's Muslim extremists, it's Muslim extremists. I don't think we made a comment on it because we didn't know, other than there was a bombing that happened. And as the thing started to unfold, and then there was a shooting at a political camp, which sounds a little like, you know, the Hitler Youth or whatever. I mean, who does a camp for kids that's all about politics? Disturbing. But anyways.
Who does a camp for kids? It is all about politics. Disturbing. June 13th, 2011, from the Tampa Times. Here's another option of how the kids, now that the kids are out of school, a week-long seminar about our nation's founding principles, courtesy of the Tampa 912 Project. 912.
It's not 9/11. That's the day before.
No, right. 9/11 is the day before. What happened on the day after? Oh, it was 9/12. Who's... What am I thinking of? It reminds me of, oh, that guy we were just listening
to. Yeah.
912. That's Glenn Beck's organization.
I remember now.
Yes, of course. The organization, which falls under the Tea Party umbrella, hopes to introduce kids ages 8 to 12 to principles that include America is good, I believe in God, Macht Frau. What is it? I work hard for what I have, and I will share it with who I want to. Government cannot force me to be charitable.
Hey, what happened?
Well, I'll be. Is Glenn Beck saying that his 912 Project camp is actually like the Hitler Youth? Let me try that again. Like the Hitler Youth? I guess so. Moving on. What an idiot he is.
He attacks the children who died, the kids who died.
Of course he does. What a just a horrible human being. But, you know, you got to, if you want to make it, you want to make it in this online business, folks. That's what it's going to take. Let's see here. What do I have in terms of news today? Oh. Bad news from Fukushima in Japan. Apparently, their Twitter's down and they can't see the naked photos or the chestless photos of Anthony Weiner. So when they're not trying to pretend that this whole News Corp hacking story, there's really no difference between actually doing the hacking or being a victim of hacking. It's the same thing. The word hacking is involved. That's all that's important. When they're not doing that, they are either being just blatantly stupid or, again, trying to pursue this false meme that there was no terrorist attacks under George Bush.
They're not conservatives. These people are right-wingers. Let's put it what they are. And by the way, George Bush didn't scare seniors. That's right. What he did was saying, if we don't go to Iraq, we're going to be subjected to weapons of mass destruction, which we still haven't found. But leaving that aside...
That is so ridiculous.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
Why?
And I've just about had it with liberals who bring that up all the time, and it's just baloney.
Go, Dana.
And there are so many... Everybody had the same information. Even one of your favorite liberals, John Kerry, they all voted for it. Secretary Clinton, when she was a senator. So why don't we just take Iraq, WMD, off
topic,
the table? We can talk about
where
social
weapons
security.
Of mass destruction
are.
Well, you know what? Whether they did or didn't, America was certainly safe between 2000 and 2008. I don't remember any terrorist attacks on American soil during that period of time.
No attacks on American soil between 2000 and 2008. No attacks. I mean, aside from the anthrax and that thing in North Carolina, and what was that other one? God damn it.
I always forget this one, too. They tell me never to forget, and I just can never remember.
That's right. It had to do with... it happened on Rudy Giuliani. No, I meant 9/11. That's what I meant. I'm sorry. Well, I get confused between the words 9/11 and Rudy Giuliani.
He doesn't even remember it either. He remember a few months back.
Unbelievable. Fox in a free fall. And, all I can say to that is two American hikers, I'm sure you heard this story, two American hikers had been imprisoned by the Iranians for more than 2 years on, which is not terribly surprising, very dubious espionage charges and highly oppressive conditions. Their names, Joshua Fattel and Shane Bauer. They were released last week. They spoke on Sunday in Manhattan at a press conference. You've read these media accounts of how Iran is evil, how we are good, how this is an example of an oppressive regime. But what most media accounts have omitted, as Glenn Greenwald points out, is the description by Fattel of the horrible conditions of prison that they were held in. He explained that of everything that was done to them, quote, solitary confinement was the worst experience of all our lives. Think back to Bradley Manning, kept in solitary confinement for a year. Think back to Jose Padilla, solitary confinement with earmuffs and black glasses over his face so he couldn't see anything. He noted that they were imprisoned due solely to what he called the 32 years of mutual hostility between America and Iran. And he said, the irony is we oppose U.S. policies towards Iran, which perpetuate this hostility. After complaining that the two court sessions they attended were total shams, military commissions, Gitmo trials, we're going to find these people guilty anyway. Does that ring a bell?
And that, quote, we've been held in almost total isolation, stripped of our rights and freedoms, he explained. And then he went on to say this.
In prison, every time we complained about our conditions, the guards would immediately remind us of comparable conditions at Guantanamo Bay. They would remind us of CIA prisons in other parts of the world and the conditions that Iranians and others experience in prisons in the U.S. We do not believe that such human rights violations on the part of our government justify what has been done to us, not for a moment. However, we do believe that these actions on the part of the U.S. However, we do believe that these actions on the part of the U.S. provide an excuse for other governments, including the government of Iran, to act in kind.
Which, of course, is what every expert on torture, which is what the military personnel say, which is what civil libertarians say in this country. It has been said over and over again. Yet we cannot talk about this because there's too much time being spent as to whether half-term, mildly, barely popular governor from New Jersey may enter into the race only to lose and leave it the day after New Hampshire. That is what is so effed up about our media. So think about that the next time you are forced to listen to whether or not Chris Christie is going to decide to run for president. Why isn't our media paying attention to those words and the implications of that in terms of civil liberties? It's just simply not convenient. Doesn't fit with the narrative.